Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. As I said, the show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, it is available on Spotify. Well, we got through another week, friends. I hope you're staying safe and healthy and sane. And I know things have loosened up as far as restrictions, but just use common sense, okay? And it's funny because after recording last week's show, I saw news that that some drive-ins are starting to open up. And, of course, that might be our gateway into getting back into the movie-going experience. It was interesting because I watched Birds of Prey, which I'll talk about in a bit. I'll get to that. But the three trailers, because it was a Warner Brothers feature, the three trailers all had films where as I saw the trailers, I said to myself, I really want to see these on a big screen. Christopher Nolan's Tenet, In the Heights, Wonder Woman 1984. And I just hope we get that opportunity. So fingers crossed there. I'll tell you to grab your pencils in just a little bit, but we're going to dip into the archives for anything I can dip into the archives. That's always good. But this one, and I've been wanting to replay this for a while because a few weeks ago I told you about the documentary American Scary, which was about the history of the local TV horror show host. And at the end of that documentary, author Neil Gaiman talks about his chance at that time. I believe this was from a 2016 documentary, but he got to do his version of a local horror show host for the Fox Movie Channel. And it was fun to see that. And also this week in the AV Club, which I highly recommend, it's one of the best entertainment websites online. And yes, it's from the people of The Onion, real writing. But this week in their series called Watch This, they come up with a theme throughout the week of recommended films. And this week it's been films that are better than their reputations or their bad box office suggests. And yesterday, Thursday's installment, was the film version of Stardust, Neil Gaiman, based off of Neil Gaiman's work. So it's a great excuse for me to replay this. This was one of my early interviews, and I couldn't believe I got this. And you might hear, you'll recognize a certain somebody in this interview as well. But going all the way back to 2010, I should say, sorry. Here is my chat with Neil Gaiman. Enjoy. Well, Neil, I didn't realize I had royalty in my studio because I know you have an official title, so I need to kiss your ring or your scepter or what, your crown.
I have an official title, but only for a week.
Really?
Yeah.
You got to renew that.
It's no. I have inherited my title from, I think, Julie Andrews. And I do not know who I will be handing it on to next year, but I am the honorary chairman of National Library Week. I get to be a spokesperson for all of the libraries in America, and I get to tell people not to close them and to go and use them and to cherish them.
Ah, so you came to Indianapolis at the right time.
I did.
Are we chaining ourselves to any libraries in the next couple of days?
Well, I'm actually going to be giving a big talk tonight that is absolutely sponsored by your local library world, which is rather wonderful. But no, I won't be chaining myself to any railings or throwing myself under horses. I'm just going to be urging people to use their libraries and to know what they've got. Mm-hmm. you know, we're in this world now where I keep hearing people telling me that libraries are so incredibly 20th century, as if Google replaced the library somehow, and trying to explain to them that the nature of information retrieval has simply changed.
I think with libraries and, for lack of a better comparison, video stores. I know, yes, you can get anything on the web and get it mailed to your home, and you don't have to see human beings. But I still think, especially a library, is a great example of the search. The search, the hunt, and whether you get what you're looking for or you find something else that comes along your path. I think that's a thrill that needs to remain.
I look back at the years I spent as a schoolboy hanging around school libraries discovering books that I did not know that I wanted. They weren't things that I was looking for. In many cases, they looked extremely unprepossessing. I remember some very, very old, battered-looking red hardbacks. One was called The Fellowship of the Ring, which seemed an incredibly unlikely sort of title. And then they had one called The Two Towers, and there were just two out of these apparently three books. And reading them and then getting to the end of The Two Towers and going, it can't end there. And so going back to the beginning and just reading those first two books of Lord of the Rings over and over again. And I don't know that I would ever have picked them up. But they were in the school library, and I was reading my way through it. So I read them.
And now they're on Blu-ray. And you can't read Blu-ray, really.
You can't. Or you can. Or you have incredibly sensitive fingers, possibly, to run around the disc.
That is true. That's true. Braille. What are you currently working on? I mean, whatever medium. It's literature, comic, film. What's in your office?
Right now, it's a bit of a gallimaufry. I've got. What am I working on? I'm doing a rewrite of an episode of Doctor Who that I wrote.
Oh.
I wrote an episode for the current season that was meant to be episode 11, but we ran out of budget. So my episode got bounced to early in season 6. So I'm doing a rewrite to take care of continuity issues and things from where it was to where it will be. I'm writing a film script for Anansi Boys, my novel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a nonfiction book about China and myth and history, which I'm starting to get into and starting to enjoy. And writing a little children's book in down moments right now.
How do you select down moments? Or, I mean, as far as juggling and writing, I mean, is it based on what creativity comes from this project or deadlines? Or, I mean,
well, there's definitely a level on which who is shouting loudest for something and when it was really due by and when it is due by and whether or not their lawyers have started sending letters saying, please note the date of the actual contractual delivery has now passed by several years and we will ask for our money back. These are all important things in what you work on. And then there's other things like what you feel like working on that day. And I always like to have something on the go in little notebooks just to hand, because you never know when you're going to wind up stuck on a plane or a hotel or an airport lobby or somewhere. And it's really nice to just sort of go visit somewhere fictional.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about. I love the idea of the credit writer/producer. Many people say, like, when they argue about the Academy Awards, that really producer and director, best film, best picture, and best director should be the same. And some of us say that best writer and best picture should be the same. So I'm wondering, I know you were executive producer on Beowulf and producer on Stardust. How much were you able, and I don't mean this way this sort of sounds, but I mean, how much creative control did you have in collaborating with both directors of those films?
I think the truth is that film will always be subject to budget limitations, a director's medium. I've now directed a couple of films, not very long ones. I did a half-hour film a few years ago, and last summer I got to, I had enormous fun directing an 8.5-minute silent movie called Statuesque, which got starring Bill Nighy. And in each case, what I liked best was I had the same power that I have as a writer in writing prose, which is the power of because I say so. Why is it like this? Because I say so. It's going to be like this. And that's something that you could have every producerial description in the book applied to you, whether it's executive producer, or you can be the boss of a studio. And the truth is, a director is going to make the film the director wants to make. And the director is the only person in a film, really, who has because I say so power.
How have you liked the film versions of your work so far?
I've really enjoyed them. I think I'm tremendously lucky.
Yeah, you have no visible scars, so it seems like
I really don't. And I'm fascinated by them. I think people think I'm a bit odd because I tend to take an incredibly long-term view anyway. And I think of film adaptations of my stuff as being kind of like theatrical adaptations, which is they come, they go, they're really interesting, but the book is still the thing. I love Stardust, the movie that Matthew Vaughn made. I was a producer on it. I really, really enjoyed it. I can also absolutely imagine a world in which 15 years from now, 20 years from now, somebody picks up the book, reads it, goes, I love this book. Then they look at the film that Matthew made and they go, you know, I want to do a different one. Mm-hmm. I'm reading this book. I'd love to make a movie of this, but it would be a completely different movie. It wouldn't be a sort of rollicking, comedic...
De Niro and drag. The most beautiful
thriller.
Witch in cinema history.
Absolutely. You know, it wouldn't be that thing. It would be something else. Coraline, I think, was slightly different in that for Coraline, when I finished the book, this is when I finished writing the book, 10 years ago, I looked at what I'd written and I thought, I would love this filmed. And then I thought, but if you filmed it live action, you're going to get something that no adult would be able to watch without being too creeped out, and I'm not even sure that kids would enjoy it. And I thought, but I love Henry Selick's work. I'd mm-hmm. loved Henry most famously directed a film, or before Coraline most famously directed a film called Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, which a lot of people, because of the title, think was directed by Tim Burton.
Right.
But it wasn't. It was by Henry. And I had seen the credits on that, and I had registered who directed it and who made that film. And likewise, James and the Giant Peach. So for me, there was only one person I wanted to do Coraline, and only one person I was going to send the book to when it was finished, which was Henry. And fortunately for both of us, he read it, he loved it, and then it took us about 5 or 6 years to get it set up. And then, because it was stop motion, which is the most labor-intensive form of filmmaking on the planet, it took, you know, a year of pre-production set building and model building, and then 2 years of shooting. And on a really, really good day, they might get 11 seconds in the can.
And he has, of all the animators out there, I think his look is the most visible. You may not know him by name, but you know that look with the three films that you mentioned. And also, I think last year is going to go down as one of the best, if not arguably the best year for film animation between all of the stuff that was nominated. And congrats on the nomination.
It was so strange being in that year. And that we got an Oscar nomination in what may have been the best year for animation ever was an honor in itself.
And that could have been a category with 10.
Oh, it could easily have been a category with 10. And also, there was a level on which, and I say this in the best possible way, up was nominated for Best Picture,
mm-hmm.
which meant, and you sort of look at that and you go, well, it won't get Best Picture, but it has to get Best Animated Picture because it's been nominated for Best Picture. So it was the most stress-free Academy Awards possible. We knew that Up would win. Everybody involved knew that Up would win. And
you got your swag bag and went out drinking afterwards.
And we had a wonderful time. Exactly. So from that perspective, it was great. I got to write the thing that I wrote that I think has had the most number of people ever seeing it, which is 15 seconds of Coraline dialogue in the Academy Awards. I wrote that for them, that little scene, and I'm going, I think that there's something ridiculous, like 250 million people watching this right mm-hmm. now.
It's fabulous. When it comes to adapting your work, first off, do you have it strictly that, you know, you get to adapt your own work and nobody else, or is it, I mean...
Truthfully, I prefer it when other people adapt my work.
Okay.
And I'm currently battling my way through an Anansi Boys adaptation that reminds me... the only reason I said yes to it was the BBC World Service had just done a radio adaptation of Anansi Boys that I had not liked and really hadn't liked, which meant that about a week after, I got a call from Warner Brothers saying they would like to buy the rights to Anansi Boys. Would I like to adapt it? And I was like, yes, I really do, because I want to do this properly. Now that I'm doing it, I'm remembering why I normally say no to adapting other people's stuff, which is simply... In order to build the thing in the first place, your mind goes down certain paths. When you're transferring something into a film, you either want to do exactly the same thing that you did before, which is a bit dull if you're a writer,
mm-hmm.
or you want to do something completely different just because it's fun and you haven't written it. And neither of these is I think, terribly healthy. For a writer, it's much more fun for me adapting something by somebody else, because then I can go with a completely clean conscience. I can look at it and go, well, you know, we can lose that character. I can't do that with my stuff. If I go, we can lose that character, in the back of my head, that character is going, no, why me? I was a good character. I was obedient. You can't lose me.
Well, I was curious also about your adaptation of Beowulf, because it seemed more, especially after a certain animated action film had come out, but it seemed more like a Shakespearean tragedy than, say, beefy guys screaming and hacking at one another.
It's a very odd film, Beowulf, isn't it? I mean, I think part of the fun of that, and which is one of the things that some people like and some people don't and different people react to in different ways, is what Roger Avery and I wrote a script for in our heads was for a $15, $20 million low budget, lots of mud and dirt Beowulf that would have been kind of like Terry Gilliam's Jabberwock.
I would say my first thought was Excalibur.
I think in our heads we had a weird mixture of Excalibur, Jabberwocky, maybe Monty Python and the Holy Grail, in terms of that kind of what we were trying to do. Bob Zemeckis fell in love with the script, and then, which suddenly meant that it was a thing starring Anthony Hopkins and Angelina Jolie and people, and Bob is also fascinated right now by motion capture mm-hmm. and by performance capture and by ways of trying to do the thing where you get to mix live action performances with an animated thing that you're seeing on the screen. So it became this kind of thing that looks like a video game, but doesn't necessarily deliver. I think for a lot of people, it looked too much like a video game for the people who actually really would have loved the Shakespearean
right.
oddness. And it was too little like a video game for the people who would have really liked a video game movie. And the people who, for whom it would have been very funny and very weird if we'd actually done it as a Jabberwocky thing, they never really got to see that. I think Roger Ebert was about the only film critic I saw who basically said, I think I'm the only film critic who has noticed this is funny. And it is funny. And it's funny. People, it's funny, which I loved.
Now, I went online, because that's where I get all my research, and I saw that there's five titles in your IMDb page under In Development. So may I throw titles at you and
throw,
you can comment?
Throw titles at I have to say that as far as I can tell, IMDb has the same kind of reliability as Wikipedia, which is anybody can go on and add anything they like.
Well, we're gonna straighten this out.
So go for it.
Here we
go.
All right. Graveyard Book.
Definitely in development. Neil Jordan is writing the script currently and is meant to be directing it.
Okay.
There's serious hope that we could be shooting by the end of the year.
Death, High Cost of Living.
Don't know. It's Death, the High Cost of Living is kind of like traffic lights. You know, I always thought when I was a young person entering the world of Hollywood nervously that the expression a green light meant that you actually had a proper green light for your film and you would go. And I didn't realize that it was kind of like traffic lights, because green lights for death go on, and then they go yellow, and then they go red, and then they go...
I was thinking the Monty Python song, but yeah, that's one of those.
So it's very, very strange. Had you asked me that 4 days ago, I would have told you that we were closer than ever before to things happening. I'd just been contacted, and the deal had just been done for me to go in and do a rewrite of my original script, and everything was grand. As of 2 days ago, Warner's apparently suddenly have had a unified field theory for the entirety of Sandman and everything I created, which no longer involves, for which death is now on hold. So I don't know. We'll find out.
We'll call you next week.
Exactly.
Road to Endor.
Road to Endor is wandering along. And it's kind of fun. It's a script that I've written with Penn Jillette of Penn and Teller.
Yes.
A true story about two guys in 1917 who escaped from a Turkish prisoner of war camp by pretending to have psychic powers and doing stage magic. And it's a completely true story about these wonderful people. And the producer... There's a producer named Hilary Bevan-Jones, who I've worked with in London, who actually produced, Pirate Radio, she produced The Girl in the Cafe, and it actually happened to her grandfather. Her grandfather was one of these two people.
Oh, wow.
So she's working with us on it. Cool. And we're just waiting for... There is a director that we want. He wants to do it. He's been tied up on a franchise of films that has occupied him for several years now. I believe he's shooting the last of them currently, and then we'll see if he's available.
Okay. Interworld.
That looks like it's happening, but as a TV series, not as an animated TV series, not as a movie.
Okay. And finally, Black Hole.
Black Hole, Roger Avery, who I did Beowulf with, who did Killing Zoe and Pulp Fiction.
Yes.
Co-writer of Pulp Fiction. And I wrote a script for Black Hole.
As far as I know,
it's in a black hole right now.
Is this a remake of the Disney film of the
same
name?
No. This is Charles Burns' wonderful graphic novel
about
a sexually transmitted disease that turns kids into teenagers into monsters.
Completely.
And forces them to go and live in the woods.
On a double bill with the Disney film.
And
that black hole was blue, by the way, from 1980.
So, no, all of the... Actually, that's not bad. But all of those films are actually real things.
Okay.
Normally when people say, I've seen this on IMDb, they come up and say, so are you really doing Doctor Strange with Guillermo del Toro? And I say, no, I'm not. I really am not.
Well, after a while, it just seems like, you know, for me, it's like I don't believe it until I see a poster and a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when actually things have happened. I had two friends, basement-dwelling friends, who were going to come to fisticuffs over Ken Branagh playing young Obi-Wan in the first three Star Wars. And I thought, really, you guys are going to fight over that? So... That's why we check in.
I love, I really do love the way that people seem to think that films are inevitable, that writers have supreme control, and that you can actually tell them what's going to happen with a film. The only thing that I know, having done all sorts of films and having knocked around in Hollywood now for 20 years every now and again, is nobody knows anything, and what will happen, and if you'd asked me in 1997 what film of mine was most likely to happen, I would have told you Beowulf, because Roger, we'd just been given the green light, and Roger was about to fly around Canada, Newfoundland, Greenland, looking for locations.
Places with mud.
Absolutely. And then if you'd asked me in 2004 if any of the film scripts I'd written would never get made, I would have said, well, definitely Beowulf. That one will never happen. That's sitting there. It's this complicated chain of ownership. Who's going to make that thing? And so I was wrong both times. These days, all I know is that they will happen when they happen.
And you love libraries.
And I do love libraries. you have a daughter.
I do. This is our film sociology kids film correspondent, Emma Sosi, and I know she's been chomping at the bit. You have questions and or comments for Neil?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, how long did it take you to write the book?
Of Coraline?
Yeah.
Coraline. You know, that shouldn't be a really hard question to ask somebody. You say, how long did it take you? And they tell you. The problem with Coraline, though, is I'm not really sure. I started writing Coraline in about 1990, maybe early 91. I showed it to an editor who read the first three chapters and said, Neil, which is what I'd written. And he said, it's really good, but obviously we can't publish it, because it's horror for children, and that's too weird. And then I moved to America. So for a period of about 6 years, I would write about 2 pages a year on Coraline. I'd just go and write a little bit. By about 1998, mm-hmm. I noticed, I moved out here in 92, I noticed that the daughter I'd started writing it for, Holly, was now probably getting to be too old for it, and that I had a young daughter who was now 4, and if I didn't get a move on, she would be too old for it by the time I finished it. So I sent what I'd written of Coraline up to that point to my editor, a lady named Jennifer Hershey, and she phoned me up and she said, it's really good, what happens next? And I said, if you send me a contract, we'll both find out. So she sent me a contract, but I didn't have any more time. So instead of reading before bed, which is what I'd always done up until that point all my life, I started writing before bed, and I had a notebook by the side of my bed, and I would write 50, 60, 70 words of Coraline, and then I'd go to sleep. And then finally, in about 2000, I went on a cruise for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, which is a First Amendment organization I'm part of to preserve the rights of people who read, who write, who draw, who sell, who publish comics. And I was an attraction on this cruise, and I was meant to be working on my novel, American Gods. But my assistant had put, by serendipity, the wrong notebook into my bag. So I got to this cruise, and I discovered that the notebook I had with me was Coraline. So on the cruise, I finished writing Coraline. So the truth is, I started writing it in 1991. I finished writing it in 2000. I have absolutely no idea how long it actually took me to write.
I see. Sometimes I try to write a book, and it takes, like, when I was 5, I tried to, like, write a book, and I got, like, halfway through it when I became 6. So it took me to write just half of the book, and it only had, like, 5 pages.
Did you ever finish it?
I'm still working on it.
That's good.
Yeah.
Finishing books is the hardest thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can start writing a book,
yeah.
But you know you're a proper author when you finish one.
Mm-hmm. Like, in our school, in our classes, we're writing a lot of books in our classes, just like small books.
I'm loving writing the small books right now.
Yeah.
They're sort of, apart from anything else, it's really nice to do something that you can finish by tea time.
Yeah.
Emma, do you have any other questions for our guest?
Also,
or
I was,
comments?
Did anyone help you write Coraline at all?
No, it was all my fault. Any glory is mine and any blame is mine too. So for the people who think that writing Coraline was definitely a bad thing to do, I have to plead guilty.
I think it's good.
Good. I'll tell you what I did do, though. I stole the initial sort of idea from my daughter. Holly was about 4 years old. She used to come home from kindergarten. She would climb on my lap and dictate stories to me. And I would write them down. And they were always terrifying stories in which little girls, normally named Holly, would come home from school and discover that their mothers had been kidnapped by evil witches who were pretending to be their mothers, who would then normally lock them in the basement. And then with the aid of ghosts, they'd have to escape from the basement pursued by witches and go and try and find their real mother. And I thought, well, that's good. I'll write something like that for her. If that's the kind of thing she likes.
That's sort of like what happens in some of my dreams sometimes.
I think it's what happens in everybody's dreams.
Yeah.
My dreams involve Terry Hatcher, but that's a whole other. I can't.
His dreams involve pretty much girls.
Especially your mother. Neil,
good answer.
Yes. Oh, I'm the third smartest person in my house.
Let's put it this,
it's true. Let's put it this way. It's a Jane Austen world. I'm just the dad. I was curious what other screenplays have come out recently that have really tapped, that you've really enjoyed watching or listening to.
What's been coming out recently that I've really enjoyed? I loved the screenplay For an Education, Nick Hornby. I thought that was beautifully constructed. And actually, the things that have impressed me no end recently are the first two Stephen Moffat episodes of the new season of Doctor Who, because I think Moffat is probably right now my favorite screenwriter.
Okay.
Absolutely fascinated with the way that he'll construct a story. And up until now, at least in sort of, you know, his work in Doctor Who and in Jekyll, he's been the scary one.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is watching him develop a whole new, have to learn a whole new range. He can't just be the scary one anymore. He has to be the welcome everybody in one, and then he has to be the exciting running about one, and it's absolutely fascinating.
I'm curious if Doctor Who fans are in England, what Star Trek fans are here in the United States?
No,
not as rabid.
it's a general thing.
Okay,
I mean Doctor Who in England is a huge shared cultural experience. You're looking at the kind of viewing figures that tell you that 10% of the population of England is watching this when it's on. I don't know what that would extrapolate to in the US, but you're looking at something that is a shared cultural experience, and it's a shared cultural experience that goes back 45 years.
Mm-hmm. It's true. You got me there.
it's what I guess Star Trek could have been.
Right. But I think I only ask because since then, I mean, and of course, it spawned a legion of films and other series, and you know, they're still talking about it, and they're obviously, you know, they made the film last year, so you know, 40 some odd years later. But I think it's a different, because there's a Deep Space Nine and there's a Next Generation. It's not like Shatner and Nimoy for the entire time. Although
the genius of Doctor Who was that moment in 1966 when the producers looked at this fairly popular, you know, and it was extremely popular TV show that they'd done. It had already spawned two spin-off movies by that point. And they looked at this and they went, our lead actor is getting too old, too doddery. He's not actually in very good health. What do? We want to keep this going. Mm-hmm. And they went, well, he's an alien. He can regenerate into somebody else. And the simplicity of that gave them something that was unmatched until anything like, you know, The Simpsons came along, for ways to cope with the fact that your actors may get old, die, or whatever.
I mean, out of Terry Gilliam's last film, with three actors replacing one.
Exactly. The glory of Doctor Who now is that you have this weird shared cultural experience where for those of us who have been through this 11 times before, watching people whose first experience of Doctor Who was David Tennant go, no, how can David Tennant stop being the Doctor and somebody else will come along? This is wrong. It will not work. And all of us going, no, Grasshopper, this will be just fine.
Make him walk on rice paper. And
absolutely.
Neil, thank you so much for spending time with us. This has been an absolute thrill.
Well, thank you both. Thank you, Emma. Great questions.
Thanks.
There you have it, my chat, along with a very young Emma Rose Soucy, interviewing Neil Gaiman back in 2010. So there you go. Your pledge dollars at work. All right, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. I'm your host, Matthew Soucy. Grab a pencil, gang. It's time. Well, I'm going to tell you what I watched first. Just so you know, they're on DVD and Blu-ray. If you need The Call of the Wild, if you need Fantasy Island, if you need, Criterion has put out a Blu-ray of The Great Escape, so you can probably get rid of all those old copies, and this will be the definitive copy of The Great Escape now available on Criterion. But for me, the big title is, yes, Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. This, of course, is starring and produced by Margot Robbie. You have Christina Hodson as a writer. You have Kathy Yan as a director. So you have a writer, director, and producer all female, and good for them. It is better than Suicide Squad. I will tell you that. I'm just happy to know that that we can have a female crew make an action film that I thought was okay, just as equally as the men can. So now I will say, there's more for Margot Robbie to do in this one, of course, because she's the leader this time around. It's her story, and she's having a lot of fun, as is Ewan McGregor as the villain, as is all the ladies that are involved in this. I wondered how the Huntress and Rosie Perez as the burnt out cop, and how I knew it was eventually in the last third turn into some version it looked like of the female Expendables, and it does do that, and the action scenes are more cartoonish than say Suicide Squad. It's not, and it's probably at a level of Joel Schumacher's Batman, only with a little more bite to it, although we do get obligatory female classic rock during an action scene. Thank you to the ladies of Heart for their contribution of Barracuda. But it's got some energy compared to Suicide Squad, and it's R-rated. I couldn't believe that there was a PG-13 rated Suicide Squad when it should have been R, and I think they correct that. This is almost like, this is at the same level as between Deadpool and Deadpool 2. So more folks are going to like it than I. And if it's this is a girls' night out, not Magic Mike, but if you want to see girl power and butt kicking females, this is the film for you. It does fall into every other action film, no matter who the gender is, for me. But it's out there. So kudos to Margot Robbie for her work in this. Okay, as I mentioned before the interview, was the drive-ins are starting to pop up and they're opening. The Tibbs have been doing new titles and old titles. At Screen One, they're showing Bloodshot and Fantasy Island, which just came out on video. Both of them just came out on video. Screen Two, Purple Rain and Dreamgirls. Screen Three, Onward and Call of the Wild. And apparently sold out. According to the website, The Vast of Night and The Aeronauts. So check your local drive-ins and see if they are open. IU Cinema, of course, is doing doing virtual stuff, as is the Can-Can, which is on Mass Ave. Yes, so go check out that if you can. If you can. There you go. Okay, now grab a pencil. It's time to, and I will tell you some other films that I watched this week, and then we will go to Facebook and Twitter and find out what y'all have been watching. So last weekend was Earlham College's graduation, as a lot of schools. My alma mater, the Ball State University, had their graduation 2 weeks ago. So, and you know, colleges have different commencement weekends. And what has become a graduation weekend tradition for me is to revisit Kevin Reynolds' 1985 gem Fandango. This was a film that I remember seeing when it came out on when it came out on video. And I ran across a group of guys in college who loved this film as much as I do. It is set in Austin, Texas, 1971, graduation weekend. We have one guy who's supposed to be getting married and in report for the draft. And the group of guys known as the Groovers decide to go through the and kind of wedged in by their leader to go on one final road trip to Mexico. Now, at the time of this film, the big name star was Judd Nelson. This was before The Breakfast Club, but he had already done Making the Grade. And the other star in this is a then unknown Kevin Costner, who was already famous for getting cut out of his scenes in The Big Chill. But it's okay. Lawrence Kasdan would pay him back this year, 1985, with a plum role in Silverado. And it's directed by Kevin Reynolds, who was a protege, I believe, of Spielberg, depending on who you talk to. Spielberg's Amblin Pictures released the film. Apparently Spielberg wasn't crazy about it and took his name off of it, but it's still Amblin Entertainment. And Reynolds and Costner would later collaborate on Waterworld and Robin Hood. He'd also make 187 and a number of films, so still working, still out there. But this is by far my favorite. It's one of my favorite road trip films. You have Thelma and Louise, Sideways, and Fandango. And it's one that I can quote quite a bit. And and some of the ad campaign try to make it into a horny teenager movie like Porky's, and it's not that. It's got more heart. It's got you have a good fivesome. In this, I believe it's Sam Robards is one of the other actors. You also see some younger faces, a then unknown Susie Amos, I believe Glenn Headley in her first film. I'm a fan of Car Wash, so seeing Pepe Serna is in it. Dottie from Pee-wee's Big Adventure has a small role, as does the gentleman who plays the pilot, who I believe this was his first film as well, and I later see him get his head bashed in by Clint Eastwood in Pale Rider. So, great soundtrack as well. This is one of those films. It opens with Badge by Cream, and anytime I hear that song, I think of this film. Just like I think of It's Too Late by Carole King, and at the end of the film they use Can't Find My Way Home and by Blind Faith, and I always think of Fandango when I hear those songs. And great best use of Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting by Elton John. And yes, I know there was an Elton John movie last year. This is still the best use of Elton John in a film. But it's got college boy shenanigans, even though Costner was, I believe, 30 when he made this. But his character is one that didn't advance academically for 3 years. So you can play it off a little easier than, say, a musical set in high school. I'm looking at you, Grease. But anyway, I'm hoping this is now that Local Hero has been given the Criterion treatment. Fandango is another one that I really hope someday gets the Criterion treatment. So it's a lovely little picture. It's guy humor with heart. It's not gross. And it's got a great soundtrack. So look for that if you can, because I have a physical copy of it. So, this is something I watch once a year. Going through my pile of Blu-rays and DVDs that I've purchased and just haven't gotten around to, and it seemed fitting because of college graduation and high school graduations are just around the corner, especially in our household with my daughter Emma. But I revisited The Perks of Being a Wallflower, and I remember really liking the film when it first came out, and I've talked at length for several shows about the current wave of high school films. And of course, I'm looking for anything that's better than the films of John Hughes. Films like Booksmart, Edge of 17, this one, obviously, and and to a certain degree, Superbad has a little more heart for me than the suburban fairy tales of Mr. Hughes's work. And so anyway, I revisited it and the fantasy, I guess the I talk about the suburban fairy tales of John Hughes films, but a freshman being able to hang out with seniors, even if they are the outsiders, the outcasts of, or as Emma Watson refers, the land of misfit toys, to be put under their wing is, but it doesn't feel forced. And everybody has their own issues. They are pals, but they have problems. And of course, the lead, our freshman, who's counting the 1,000+ days that he has in high school. It's just a wonderful up and down look at a freshman year in high school. And the one issue I've had with the film, and it is addressed in the commentary. There is a commentary track by the author who also wrote and directed the film, and then another one with his cast. And you have a really cool soundtrack of music by The Smiths, Sonic Youth, Morrissey, Love and Rockets, XTC, New Order. And there's the famous scene of the kids going through the tunnel, the Pittsburgh tunnel, in the pickup truck. And the Emma Watson character had never heard Heroes by David Bowie. And somebody told me that in the book, it's a Fleetwood Mac song. I need to actually get a physical copy of the book and see if that is true. But the author who adapted the book and directed the film, his excuse, and he actually brings it up in the commentary track, that he got guff for her not knowing what that it was David Bowie doing Heroes, because at that time he referred to David Bowie, he only knew David Bowie as the Let's Dance guy, didn't know the earlier musical incarnations of David Bowie. So at least he brings it up. I still... anyway, but so I guess if you just know him from MTV, you're not going to know the earlier work. So, you know, at least he brought it up, and it made me laugh out loud listening to that, and the fact that he brought it up on two commentary tracks. The thing that really bummed me out watching it, revisiting it, especially in these times, and I don't know how things are in your household, but you know, I have a daughter who's about ready to graduate high school, and we're waiting to find out if she is going away to college, because we don't know what schools are going to be open and be allowed. But the scene of all the kids in the hallway, the seniors in the hallway, counting down the seconds until their last day of school is over, and my daughter's not going to get that. You know, commencement's going to be virtual, and that really kind of hit hard. I don't think I've told her that. If she's listening to the show, she'll know. But yeah. So it was tough to watch that scene for me. And but she, I don't know. She knows. She's been handling it really, really well and understands. I believe, and I'm paraphrasing Mrs. Sosie when she says she's been wanting to get out of the house since the second grade. So she's just one step closer. But that's just kind of one of those things that and I got to do mine twice. I remember I took five classes my senior year after doing 3 years of six classes, and celebrated as soon as my classes were done, ran the 7-Eleven, and then drove back and did the end of sixth period with my friends. So I got to do that twice. So anyway, but if you get a chance, look for The Perks of Being a Wallflower. It's a lovely little film, especially if you have kids graduating soon. Going back to Criterion, I revisited the 1987 John Sayles film Matewan, and I'm also one of those, I think every John Sayles film should get the Criterion treatment. And it's a clean transfer. The mining scenes, because it's set in West Virginia in 1920, a union is trying to form amongst the miners, and of course the big mining company will have none of that, and the war over the union. And the scenes inside the mines and a lot of dark scenes in the woods are much clearer this time around. It's because of the transfer. I love Sayles' writing. He covers a vast amount of territory in his films and genres, and like David Bowie, like Frank Zappa, you never know what you're going to get next from John Sayles. And I really, really enjoy that. This was the film debut of Chris Cooper. Very young Mary McDonnell is in this as well. David Strathairn, who was already one of the John Sayles players. Will Oldham is in this. Kevin Tye. James Earl Jones was the big name in this film. He got to represent the African American and the African American miners that were brought up from the South to come and work in West Virginia. They were brought in as well as Italian immigrants to be scabs. But there's a lot of locals versus outsiders, whether it's in the mining community, in the town, with the factory worker, or the mining town, the mining people themselves. A great commentary track by John Sayles and cinematographer Haskell Wexler, who received the nomination for this work and well deserved. But just a great film about locals versus outsiders and the war over the Union. This would be a fun double feature with Blue Collar, the Paul Schrader film from 1977, where Union and management are a little too cozy. So next film, and I decided to stick with Criterion, and what I've been trying to do, midnight movies. In fact, Fandango was my midnight movie last week after doing the Saturday Night House Party. But I revisited A Hard Day's Night. And this is a film that I enjoy a great deal. And listening to the commentary track, you know, for those who don't know, it's the Beatles, the first film of the Beatles, directed by Richard Lester, who had already done some commercials and some short films, worked with the Goons. And, you know, it's 2 days in the life of the Beatles, a fictional 2 days in the life of the Beatles. And it's kind of French New Wave meets the early incarnations of the music video. And I believe in the early incarnations of MTV, you actually had videos from this film of the Beatle performances. And of course, the beautiful black and white photography and great camera work. But it was a game changer because of the films prior to this were either Elvis movies, or in England, the Cliff Richard movies, or the jukebox movies, where you had a very flimsy plot and it was an excuse for bands to come on and play one or two songs and then disappear. And whether they were good songs or bad. And the Beatles didn't want to do that. And they didn't want to do Cliff Richard films like Summer Holiday, which, by the way, we actually love Summer Holiday in our household. I love A Hard Day's Night equally as much as Summer Holiday, even though it's a better made film. But it was just the energy of it. And I forgot that this film got two Academy Award nominations, one for the music score, which isn't a lot. It's like 45 seconds. It's like the full Monty getting a nomination, and for screenplay. And a lot of people assume that the majority of this film is improvised. It helped that you had a Liverpool screenwriter doing the script, but he was able to capture the Liverpool cadences. And I believe only, according to Richard Lester, about 10 to 15% of this film is improvised. So it's kind of reminds me of like a Cassavetes film, where the entire film feels like it's improvised, but it was written. So anyway, it was just a fun romp to revisit A Hard Day's Night. And of course, there's a slew of special features on this. Roger Ebert said he taught the film five times and has done the shot for shot that he would do at his festival, and refers to it as his favorite musical. I believe he said it was like A Hard Day's Night and then Singing in the Rain. So lots of fun. And it was just really kind of cool to revisit that. I tend to pick out titles at random. Either it's brought up in my head or somebody else will mention a film and I should go, I should check that out. Like, for instance, I got to give kudos to my friend Robin Zitnik. She's been doing two movies a day of films that influence her that she enjoys a great deal. And it was a film that she brought up earlier this week, and it was also on my pile and I wanted to watch it. It was fun to revisit House of Flying Daggers. the visual feast of a martial arts film from the director of Hero and House of Flying Daggers. And, of course, the young lady from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is in this as well. A dancer associated with a Robin Hood-like gang is captured, and she's torn between two men, not feeling like a fool. This was a film that received the Best Cinematography nomination, and well-deserved. There was that in the early aughts you had the and I think a part of it was because of Crouching Tiger, but the gorgeous looking martial arts films. So, and a lot of wire work had become acceptable to do that mixed in with actual, you know, with actual fighting, actual physical fighting. So anyway, it was really, like I said, a great visual feast, great stunt work, and the battle between heart, your heart and your loyalty. So it was fun to revisit that. And thanks to Robin Zitnik for putting that title upon me. All right, gang. Grab a pencil. That's what I've watched. Here is what you have watched. You know, the royal you. Back on my email from Eric, who was working, of course. First time viewing, he got to watch Muriel's Wedding, which he deemed excellent. Versama, which was from last year, which he deemed great. And Sanjuro, which he deemed outstanding. That is the follow-up to Akira Kurosawa's Yojimbo, and if you're a fan of A Fistful of Dollars, you should know that. He also revisited Horse Feathers, which is excellent, and we already and of course it is an excellent comedy. So thank you for that, Eric. All right, Nancy emailed me this Thursday morning, and so I think she'll let me read this because I'm not reading her last name. Hi. So we have a theory that there is a movie on with Brad Pitt in it at all times. That's similar, Nancy, to a scene in PCU where a guy was doing a thesis paper on, at one time, a film starring either Gene Hackman and or Michael Caine are on TV at all times. So that's a new generational thing. Here's what we watched recently. She adds, Hamlet 2, Snatch, Almost Famous, Seven, and The Gentlemen. Oh, and Fight Club, which should not be watched before bed, Crazy Dreams. I agree, Nancy. Thank you. Okay, going to Twitter. Let's see. We start with at DaddyPants2020. Thanks, Jay. Finished up Django Unchained a few nights ago. It is something to behold, not for the faint of heart, to be sure. Yes. At JenNick72, hi, Crafty, I watched The Killing of a Sacred Deer, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. I'm sorry, I said the title wrong. It should be The Killing of the Sacred Deer, or A Sacred Deer. But yeah, I understand. Cody Stark, his is at TV Cody. I'm doing the Marvel movie Gauntlet. I'm now on Hulk. At Kilkenny, Timothy Kilkenny, nothing better than old school 80s movie. I'm all down to the Cannonball Run. Thank you. At Cantankerous CM, Forrest Gump and Saving Ryan's Privates. Chris, I'm going to take your word for that. At Mare underscore E underscore, that's Mary Kay Fisher, Twister, that film still stands up after 20 years plus. My son likes it. There's also been a lot of, obviously, parents showing their daughters and sons films from our childhood, and it doesn't always go well. So kudos, Mary. At Alvid Gold Bugs, Mark Harriet, incredible movie. At D21 Winters, Noah Pappas, Shrek 2. At Hello, I'm Darian, a little Wes Anderson, the Darjeeling Limited. Very good. At Chewy Walrus, he gives me his list, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, I Am Mother, The Muppet Movie, Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives, oof, Big Trouble in Little China, Down Periscope, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Freddy's Revenge, Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter, Friday the 13th, Part 3, Friday the 13th, Part 2. I probably should have read that in reverse order, but that's what Chewy Walrus watched this week. At GGabbard42, Harold and Maude. At Liar Brain, Mystic Pizza, The Tree of Life, and People Will Talk. If I'm not mistaken, I saw... oh, that's Daddy Pants. Sorry, that's a different thing. So cool. The very good stuff there. All right. Here we go on Facebook. Drew writes Gretel and Hansel. Emily chimes in with John Wick. JJ writes recently Raw, Gross Point Blank, The Platform. Oh, and Blind Woman's Curse. Awesome. David writes Blazing Saddles, revisiting an old friend. Jared writes The Matrix and Saving Mr. Banks. Kelsey writes Hotel Artemis. It was pretty fun, some lovely characters and entertaining performances. Sarah writes The Half of It, my new favorite film. Gretchen writes, watched Pretty in Pink with my 15-year-old daughter last night. Couldn't believe how terrible it was, and that was when it first came out when I was a teen. I thought it was so deep. Uh-huh. I know. And by the way, I have railed for years about the films of John Hughes. I did offer to Emma, if she wanted to watch the John Hughes films with me, I would look for them online, because I don't own them, and see if she wants to watch those. She's already seen The Breakfast Club without me, and she really doesn't need to see that one again, she tells me. So anyway, the offer is there. We'll see if she takes me up on it. But yeah, nostalgia's a thing, isn't it? Patty writes, the first three Inspector Migrant series episodes, films, starring Rowan Atkinson. I didn't know he did drama, and they're really well done. Christy writes, I'm still in bed with Richard Chamberlain and Rachel Ward, and it's delicious. Christy's watching The Thornbirds, folks. Daniel writes, Disney's Robin Hood, Pain and Glory, The Flower of My Secret, Sherlock Holmes and the Case of the Silk Stocking, Suspicion, Clash of the Titans, To Be or Not to Be, and The Third Man. Never forget, Daniel, The Cuckoo Clock. Molly writes, The Hustle, The Meg, Lady and the Tramp, 2019, What We Do in the Shadows. Michael writes, Once We're Brothers. A different Michael writes, The French Connection, 48 Hours, Aloha, Bobby and Rose. Good call there. Paul LaMatt film with Tim McIntyre. And The Blues Brothers. Mike, not Michael, and not the other Michael, Bad Education. It was great. I've been meaning to check on that one out, Mike. Connor writes, Midsummer, Guns Akimbo, and Ratatouille. Jen writes, for Mother's Day, I made my kids watch The Princess Bride with me. So worth it. Nick writes, it's Nick Rogers. Dirty Harry, Magnum Force, The Enforcer, Sudden Impact, The Deadpool, and also Office Space. Man's got to know his limitations. Ronald writes, The Hustler. Doug chimes in, I just rewatched that a couple weeks ago. Bleak World, good acting. I remember showing Emma the first half hour of that, and she was, probably about 8. And we only lasted half an hour because she said, Dad, the pool scenes are great, and then I don't understand what's going on. So I might have to revisit that with her. You would not believe the scroll of titles that I would like to show my daughter. It's a work in progress. Chris writes, Star Wars, A New Hope, Dark Waters, Contagion, The Martian, Monty Python's Life of Brian, National Treasure 1 and 2, The Inventor, Out for Blood in Silicon Valley. Jennifer writes, Grace and I watched The Empire Strikes Back and then Toy Story 2 for the parody, and I watched part of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. We're kind of on the same page. Other than that, been binging Homeland. Let's see. Michelle writes, binge Dead to Me season 2, so I can't help you, but I read it anyway. Melissa writes, Encino Man, because I love Brandon Fraser, yet I had never seen this movie. And now you have. Mike writes, Whitney. That's the Whitney Houston documentary. Amy writes, The Peanut Butter Falcon. Rachel writes, Crazy Stupid Love and What a Girl Wants. Did you have Haagen-Dazs while watching that? Darren writes, Rosemary's Baby, History of the World Part 1, Spider-Man Homecoming, Star Wars, and The Last Jedi. Our very own Jill Sheridan chimed in and said she watched Yesterday. Michelle chimed in with Girls Trip, The Hustler, and Birds of Prey. Doug chimes in with This Time for Keeps, the Esther Williams, Jimmy Durante musical comedy, You're in the Army Now, a Jimmy Durante, Phil Silvers comedy, and lots of episodes of Ozark. Leanne writes, Green Book. Bill writes, The Dead Zone, the 1982 film. I'll read what it is. The 1982 film about a guy with disturbing visions of the future, a movie which, not a new observation here, I know, seems to offer its own disturbingly accurate vision of a 2016 presidential candidate. Nice work there, Bill. John writes, The Last Waltz, about 2 in the morning last week sometime. Anna writes, I finally watched Misery, and I'm very mad I had put it off. Anna, it happens. There was a long period of time where I couldn't understand people who said, I have to be in the mood. I was one of those guys that could watch anything at any time. And then at the end of my junior year of college, when my mother passed away, it shifted a little bit. It also helped that much later on when I had a child in the house, and I had to actually start thinking about what I was going to watch, especially with the child in the room. Not the room. That's a different thing. Okay, back to the list here. Michelle writes, Thor, The Dark World. Lou writes, The Wrong Missy. Go ahead, judge me. That's a David Spade film on Netflix that's produced by Adam Sandler. Michelle writes, I've also been binging For All Mankind. Moveen writes, the documentary film Out of Ireland. Abby writes, The Crying Game, Back to the Future, I'd never seen it, and The Social Network. Also, The Money Pit and Gerald's Game. John writes, Romancing the Stone and Ocean's 12. Cindy writes, a pretty stupid but fun Kristen Wiig movie, Girl Most Likely To. Definitely deserve better than the 22% from Rotten Tomatoes. Well, that's why I don't need numbers from Rotten Tomatoes, so it's okay. You enjoy what you enjoy. Lisa writes, The Jerk, Smoke Signals, and Dance Me Outside. Chloe writes, watch 12 Angry Men for the first time for a film club I'm in, and then immediately dumb myself down by knowingly watching the worst movie of 2018, Little Italy. Okay. Andrea writes, Hustlers, quite good. I don't think I agree with the idea that J-Lo should have gotten an Oscar for it, but it was entertaining. She should have been nominated, not necessarily won the award, but... Ben writes, The Lighthouse, It Chapter 2. And Andrea made our family watch all three How to Train Your Dragons in one day. Oof. Hey, sometimes you got to take one for the team there, Ben. Diana writes, House at the End of the Street, Gerald's Game, Dead to Me Season 2, Small Apartments, Inside Llewyn Davis, Bad Education, The Greatest Showman, The Disaster Artist, What Line? What is Line? The Wild and Wonderful Whites of West Virginia, and Six Balloons. It took way too long for the meaning of that title to hit me. It happens. James also writes he watched The Wrong Missy. It's on Netflix. David writes Ant-Man and the Wasp, Infinity War, Black Panther, Thor Ragnarok, Homecoming, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, and Doctor Strange. Jeff writes The Departed. I can watch it over and over. I'm with you, Jeff, and I do like The Final Image. Y'all just have to deal with it. Frank writes, lots of documentaries. Keith Richards, Miles Davis, Malcolm X. Great stuff, real life. Chris writes, 1976's Taxi Driver. I've been meaning to show that one to Emma, too. I don't know how she'll respond. Mike writes, The Irishman. Julia writes, and Julia might be my new patient. I also refer to her as beautiful NJ. If you tell me on the street, if you see me on the street, I'll tell you why. The Bear, Sonic the Hedgehog, Cold Mountain, Castaway, and Dances with Wolves. Mel writes Pitch Perfect 1 and 2. Taylor writes The Keeper of the Flame, Hugo, two different versions of Murder on the Orient Express. I am guessing, Taylor, Kenneth Branagh's and Sidney Lumet's. If you saw the TV one with Alfred Molina as Poirot, I'd be impressed. Stalag 17, Twins of Evil. I have that on Blu-ray. Peter Cushing. The Lincoln Lawyer, The Favorite, which he's put in parentheses, terrible. Wonder Woman, Murder at the Gallop, Mildred Pierce, Double Indemnity, and The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. If you want an anti-James Bond film, check out The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. Richard Burton, really good Richard Burton performance, and directed by Martin Ritt. Amy writes Unstoppable, Shazam, and Crazy Rich Asians. Denise writes, does Dr. Horrible sing-along blog count? No? Ah, well, we did have a Star Wars marathon. Denise, you can count. People have been putting on TV shows that they've been binging, so that's all right. John writes, thank you for smoking. Enemy of the State, Suicide Kings, and Unknown. Mary writes, DOA, The Mist, and 39 Steps. Zachariah writes, Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink, The Big Lebowski, Uncle Buck, The Funeral, and The Money Pit. Lynn Stafford, for you old Art of the Matter fans, this beautiful, fantastic small film, well acted and directed, this beautiful, fantastic. So, Tim just gave me a gif of Tom Cruise in Top Gun saying it's classified. So you watch Top Gun. And by the way, speaking of the AV Club, they do every other week, they do the top money. They'll highlight the top money making film of a particular year. This week it's 1986 and they talk about Top Gun. So go check that out. And I'm not getting paid by the AV Club. Tom writes, my man Godfrey and Son of Frankenstein. You can tell Rathbone didn't love making the film, but some of Lugosi's best work and the inspiration for about 90% of Young Frankenstein. Annie writes, we've been watching Margaret with Rowan Atkinson as the main detective. Outstanding series. Too bad there were only 4 episodes. Well, it happens, buddy. William writes The Accountant. Emily writes Oliver and Company. Julie writes Kung Fu Shuffle. It was a trip. First 15 minutes were slow, then totally engaging. Jay writes Green Book. Saw it in the theater, then again on Showtime last night. Good movie. Tony writes, the entire episodes of The Outer Limits. Tony, I hope you're doing okay. Jamie writes, I've been watching Survivor, but I plan on watching The Rise of Skywalker this weekend. Craig writes, Darkest Hour. That's for you Churchill fans out there. Lori writes, The Last Full Measure. Disappointed to learn Hollywood took liberties and totally created a fictional character as the main part of the story. Space Cowboys, because why not? Clint Eastwood, Tommy Lee Jones, Donald Sutherland, etc. The Money Pit, Never Gets Old, and Ken Burns' Baseball. Steven writes, The Hours and the Times, magnificent. Hadn't rewatched it since its original release. The Railroader and Buster Keaton Rides Again. The latter, a documentary about the making of the former, was infinitely more satisfying. And Fritz Lang's Dr. Mabuse the Gambler. We also watch Andrew Scott in Simon Stevens' Seawall, devastating. And Scott was flawless. A Zoom reading of Naomi Wallace's One Flea Spare, New York City Ballet performing Concerto DSCH, gorgeous. And the American Ballet Theater Virtual Gala, plus archival recordings of several dances choreographed by Jerome Robbins and George Balanchine. Perhaps tonight, perhaps the Metropolitan Opera's production of Billy Budd and a colleague's reading of Poe's The Mask of the Red Death. Tracy writes, Circus of Books. It was the most fascinating display of religious convictions and career aspirations. A must see. Susanna writes, What We Do in the Shadows, Contagion, and The Goldfinch. Abby writes, I went on a bit of a Marvel spree. All 3 Captain America films, Black Panther, Avengers Infinity War, and Endgame. Then switch gears to A Knight's Tale and backtrack to Wonder Woman. Rachel writes, The Little Mermaid and The Neverending Story. In that order. Mark writes, The Rainmaker, the Francis Ford Coppola film with Matt Damon. Jared writes, Brendan Fraser's The Mummy. Britt writes, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Frozen, Frozen 2, How to Train Your Dragon, all 3 of them. The Greatest Showman, both Mamma Mia's, Alvin and the Chipmunks, Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, Troop Zero, Escape from Alcatraz, Return of the Seven, and A Secret Love. Thank you, Britt. Janet writes, Book Club, White Boy Rick, The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane, Letters to Juliet, Platoon, Hustlers, Roxanne, Giant, This Property is Condemned, and Gypsy. Martin writes, in a John Wayne Western mode, Stagecoach and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Trying to decide who is the better character actor, Thomas Mitchell as the drunk doctor or Edmund O'Brien as the drunk newspaper editor. I call it a draw. Elaine writes Ex Machina. Cassandra writes Disney's Princess and the Frog. Teresa writes Wonder Woman. Andrew writes a Paddy Chayefsky double feature, Network and The Hospital. Nice stuff there. Robert Muggy, who's been on the show, and I got to get him back on, rewatched Renoir's Beau Doucet from Drowning and A Day in the Country as I shared them with my wife, Diana, and friend, Wes Gehring, who I adore as well. Jeff writes, Napoleon Dynamite, The Brother Solomon, and Reversal of Fortune. And Reversal of Fortune is another one I need to show Emma. So we'll see if we get there. Gary writes, The Adventures of Prince Ahmed. Aggie writes Fosse Verdon, which I also want to check that out. Wendell writes Snatch with Brad Pitt and Jason Statham. Beverly writes Spider-Man. And then finally, who's been on the show before, Simon Majumder, who whose new episode of Eat My Globe is up, and it's about the history of pork. He watched Ip Man. So thank you for that, Simon. And there you go, folks. That's hope you got some inspiration. Hope you got some ideas of films to watch. There's plenty out there if you just look. So hang in there. Ladies and gentlemen, friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Please stay safe, stay healthy, stay sane. Think about it before going out is all I can say there. We're going to end this week's show with a little audio featuring comedian Jerry Stiller, who passed away this week, I believe at the age of 92. And Fresh Air replayed an interview that Terry did with him. And I know for the most part, Jerry Stiller's, I said this at the day of his death, there's more to Jerry Stiller than Serenity Now and Festivus. And yes, he's best known for Seinfeld as well as King of Queens, but he has a career going all the way back to the late 50s. Of course, he had a great comedy team with his wife, Ann Mira, and yeah, they later made Ben. But he also appeared in films like The Taking of the Pelham 123, Airport 75, The Ritz, Nasty Habits, Those Lips, Those Eyes, just a slew of stuff. Seize the Day, Hot Pursuit, Nadine. He was the father in John Waters' film of Hairspray from 1988, and then he was brought back in for a lovely cameo as Mr. Pinky in the musical version of Hairspray. What else? Little Vegas, The Pickle, Highway to Hell, Heavyweights, A Rat's Tale, Stag, The Deli, A Fish in the Bathtub, The Independent, On the Line. Yes, he was in Zoolander. Anytime Ben could get his parents in, that was always good. The remake of The Heartbreak Kid, Swinging with the Finkels, Cousins, Excuse Me for a Living, and Zoolander 2. And that was his last credit, except for Zoolander's Supermodel, which was a TV movie, both in 2016. So anyway, a full career from Jerry Stiller. And I want to leave you with a little bit of audio of Stiller and Mira from the early 60s on the Tonight Show. So anyway, go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Thank you very much. Recently, there's been a lot of talk about computers in the newspapers. They've even managed to date people with the help of computers. So Jerry and I would like you to meet a couple who have been ideally matched by a computer, and they meet for the very first time.
How do you do?
How do you do?
I'm Hershey Horowitz.
I'm Mary Elizabeth Doyle.
Doyle?
Horowitz.
Horowitz. H-O-R-O-W-I-T-Z. Hershey. My friends call me Hesh.
Doyle. D-O-Y-L-E. My friends call me Mary Elizabeth.
Is Doyle your real name?
Sure. Why wouldn't it be my real name?
I don't know. I mean, I was just hoping you...
No, we're Doyle. We're Dempsey's on my mother's side.
Dempsey.
Horowitz.
Schmullowitz on my mother's side. this computer's a very good thing.
Oh, it's terrific.
I was reading all about it, you know.
All the guesswork at a meeting somewhere.
Yeah.
Electronics, so yeah. You can't make any mistakes.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!